Welcome to the Sober and Messer podcast. Before we start this week's, well, this year's review of Spanish politics and or Spain in general, we'd like to announce that the Sober and Messer podcast is launching a Buy Me a Coffee. So the link is in the description, and we're asking all listeners to buy us a coffee so that we can make the podcast more sustainable for the future. So far this year, we've racked up 1,000 minutes of audio content, and we've produced about 25 episodes. So we've interviewed various journalists, and we've even started having our first politicians. Owen, who what episodes do you are most memorable for you from this year?
Hey, Alan. God, there's been a lot. I mean, I really like some of the sort of cultural takes. We had a great one on Gaudi and anarchism, for example, on the two Spains, Spain's urbanism, various things on gentrification. I think one of the things we do quite well is, and it's down to our guests, the top quality guests we get on, is we get really interesting alternative takes on Spain and Spanish culture, Spanish society, which you might not get elsewhere. And so we've done a lot of politics this year because it's been an election year. But in some ways, some of the episodes I think that will continue to be listened to going forward are really the ones about different aspects of Spanish culture and Spanish society.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I don't really have personal favorites, but one of my favorites was talking to the son of the International Brigader, Jack
Oh,
Jones.
that was a great episode.
I mean, that's just a guess that you cannot, you couldn't invent them. And if
No,
they didn't
I could
exist,
have,
you'd
yeah,
have to.
I could have talked to Jim all day. He's a
Yeah.
great guest.
Yeah. And just how the, how we've seen the International Brigades is completely different to how he, as a son of an international brigade, has seen the sort of stereotype of international brigades change, really.
Well, we have one of our other favorite guests with us today, Professor Joe Haslam. Hey, Joe, how are things?
Very good, Owen. Very good, Alan. I see you guys struggling with the commercial end of the operation.
We're not natural salespeople, probably. It's
And
true.
also,
No.
Give us
good
your.
lefty. Let me make a joke here. I was going to say, as good lefties, you're always reluctant to mention names. Like
It's
tell them nothing.
a collective endeavor. No, and give us your pitch for the podcast. Why should people buy us a beer?
Well, sadly we lost Shane McGowan recently, and Bruce Springsteen said that Shane McGowan songs will be listened to in 100 years. And some of the content you've done, I do a lot of business content, and it's out of date in 18 months kind of thing, or even less, because some of it is out of date in 16 months. But the kind of stuff that you guys do, I think a lot of it was to be relevant in 5 years, 10 years even, so some PhD is going to struggle your come across your archive and jump for joy, I also like the fact that we shouldn't be afraid of anti-intellectualism. There's this notion that the world is all tick-tocking and that kind of stuff, and you like to think that podcasts allow people to go in. And an awful lot of academics, which I guess I am, that's what it says in my job description, they undervalue their scholarship. They think kind of everyone knows this kind of stuff. Everyone knows why we have dinner at 2 o'clock in Spain, and everyone knows why Barcelona is designed the way it is, and everyone knows why there are towns and that are still that haven't been changed since the Civil War. Like, they think everyone knows all this stuff, and it's not true at all. And even after the 20 years I've lived in Spain, there's still like new stuff that I come across all the time.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so starting off our review of 2023, I think one of the best ways to introduce it is, was your article in the Guardian, Owen? Sanchez, the most popular left wing polit well, not popular, most successful left wing politician in Europe. I think it's
Yeah,
turned out to be completely true, right?
it did, and that was a line buried in that article, and he was one of the socialist ministers picked up on it and then ran with it. And it's true. Like, I mean, I very much meant, electorally he is the most successful. I mean, it's an incredible thing. I think we have as our first heading to talk you know, Sanchez's year of living dangerously. And, you know, he took two huge gambles this year. The first one has really paid off. The second one we need to see going forward, i.e. the amnesty law. But his ability to forge a path forward when it looks as if he's pretty much trapped in a corner, once again, politically dead. I mean, it is, you can only be impressed. And I think, yeah, he's shown himself to be, you know, a brilliant politician who's able to forge quite difficult governing alliances, able to sort of work with seemingly contradictory positions, contradictory actors, and, you know, has managed to get another 4 years in office.
What do you think, he's changed much, Joe? Do you think the Pedro Sanchez of 2017 is the same Pedro Sanchez in 2023?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked about this recently, and the answer I gave was that I think there was always this thing about how much of a creation he was and how much of it came from self. And, you know, he has very good advisors, some of whom no longer work with him and now write regularly columns. But it seems that he has good political instincts, you know, that I think we can see in the case of people like Ayuso. She's very much a creation, you know, very much an Eliza Doolittle of her times. To use a very dated reference, but it's I think Sanchez, I mean, he gets so much right and also gets so much right in kind of situations that it must have been his idea. So I start to think that he personally deserves a lot of credit. I think 5 years ago, you could have said, because I mean, he was famously kind of picked out and fast-tracked. He was like, who's that guy over there? You know? And he, you know, so there was some people were saying he was a sort of a, you know, a Ken, like Barbie and Ken kind of stuff, but that he didn't really have any substance behind him. But I think what the last year, certainly, and even before that, you know, when he was zipping around in his Peugeot, and I mean, he's had, as Owen said, about three or four, like, you know, near death experiences, and he's always come out stronger. So, you know, I guess you can sort of say, like, when it keeps happening, you have to sort of say that it's more than look, that he has good political instincts, and then he seems to be able to not just, you know, identify good tactics, but also carry them through. So I think we, you know, we can now proclaim at the end of 23, you know, that he's a proper kind of a politician of stature. He isn't just a Ken or a media creation.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have said they've underestimated him. No, I mean, I think 2015, 2014, was he just this sort of Ken doll creation? Exactly. But he's shown himself. I mean, we go back to when he initially lost the leadership of the Socialist Party. I mean, his comeback then, you know, is a thing of legend at this point. That, I mean, the whole party abandoned him, and yeah, he you know, he toured the country in his family's Peugeot. You know, you can talk about different advisors he's had, such as Ivan Redondo, but he's only been there for one particular stage. It has been a much more consistent thing. His flexibility as a leader, his ability, he's willing to tack right when he needs to, but he's also willing to work with the left. We can look, and this is something maybe we can talk about, is his positioning on Catalonia in particular has always been very interesting. He came in his comeback after losing the leadership, he talked about a plurinational Spain. He talked about the need for, you know, a new territorial arrangement. Then after the 1st of October, the referendum, he tacked right. He went with, he felt, particularly after the famous King Felipe's speech, authoritarian, you know, speech, he went, he tacked right. He wasn't willing to confront head on the Spanish establishment. And I think that's the thing, is he's a great manager of time. He's a great, you know, in terms of, he knows when he should risk something, when there is an opening for audacity, and when there's a need to just go with the current, even if that's dragging him to the right. You know, he's not...
I mean, he plays...
Yeah, sorry,
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, he plays with what he's got. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't play with any ideals, or he's a very pragmatic politician, which is, I suppose, for me, he kind of moves on to the next bit, which is kind of like, did he underestimate the backlash for the amnesty? Because it was a very practical move to... And it's been seen by many to be a very practical move, even though many people agree with, you know, the pardoning or the amnesty of Catalonia. I certainly do. But it's been seen by many as a practical solution to continue governing Spain for the next 4 years. So do you think he underestimated it, this backlash?
Well, I mean, the other theory is, of course, is he was getting that heat anyway, you know. So, you know, people who don't like him, I mean, the ludicrousness of calling him names and stuff like that is such a pathetic sort of a thing, you know. So if you want to give people are coming at you, you might as well, you're getting it anyway, you know. And then, I mean, I know you have all the people reporting and things like that, but it's just a creation of, like, Falange people and you know, from an Irish point of view, I was particularly kind of amused to see there's a group that turn up and say the rosary, you know, which I think is a sort of, like, you know, whenever I feel like I'm missing home, you know, there's those in Ireland, whatever, those a group that'll turn up and just say the rosary, you know, with a mass be out of the question kind of stuff. So there's a second group, I think. I'm not sure whether they're praying for the independence of whatever, but that kind of stuff. So
I think they were praying for the souls of Spaniards, we'll get on to sort of, what do they call it, the Otoño Nacional or whatever, but like Spain's patriotic, you know, revolt. But one of the things, particularly the last 4 years, first with Pablo Casado, now with Feijóo and with Abascal in the background, I mean, Sanchez has faced pretty mediocre political opponents in that sense, you know. They aren't particularly effective politicians. But I think you're right. Like, I mean, look, the three of us live in Madrid. I don't know what you guys have had, but I'm always slightly shocked, I guess, at the deeply felt nature of Spanish nationalism sometimes. You know, there is a lot of people, even, you know, socialist voters are against the amnesty. I have to say, I was shocked, particularly, you know, we're talking about this progressive electoral victory in July, you know, against all the predictions, all the polls. There was a sense, you know, Spain has booked the trend. It hasn't turned right. And then we've had this sort of reactionary wave against the amnesty law. And I think when you look at the polling, you know, the polling, obviously, polling wasn't great for the elections either, but you're talking like 60% of people are opposed to the amnesty. Obviously, it's more complicated when you're still given a choice. Well, look, the alternative is Pepe and Vox. They will still probably go for Sanchez. But I guess the question is, yeah, did he underestimate? I mean, and it's too early to tell. I mean, we need to see what develops in the next year, etc.
You know, there's a long history of anti-Catalan, kind of being against the sort of Catalans think they're better than us. The Catalans think this, the Catalans think that. And I think, you know, like you're saying, there are, I mean, it's undeniable that there are a large amount of PSOE voters, I suppose they would be.
The problem against
Catalonia, against the amnesty. And
this weird legal formalism, like that, you know. The law is the law.
It's
bizarre.
There's about three things you've gone over there. And as a professor, I have to keep order in the classroom, okay? So, the first thing is, what Owen says is correct, that there is this kind of anti-Catalan stuff. But, you know, it's like that thing about, I hate immigrants, except for the ones I've met, they all seem very nice. I hate Catalans, except for the ones I've met, they all seem very nice. So there's this, like, kind of like they... You know, I used to work in the travel business at a travel company, so I would spend a lot of time in Barcelona and in other various nice places to go in Catalonia. So you get to meet a lot of them. And, you know, one of the things is it's very much like Catalans, a lot of them would say, like, I reserve the right to say this, but it's not what I really believe, you know. It's like, so it's almost like, you know, just because I sleep with men, I'm not gay, you know. It's like, just because I believe in the right to referendum doesn't mean I want to vote to leave Spain. And you get an awful lot of that. It's almost like I want the right to it because that is important to me. But not to actually do the thing. And, you know, I think we'd all agree, because we've discussed it in a previous podcast, you know, the whole process thing, it didn't start to where it ended up. And it just kind of developed a life of its own. And I think I certainly agree it was badly handled, in particular by Rajoy. And, you know, if we want to talk, this connects us to this legal constructionism kind of stuff, which is a huge part of the argument. I mean, judges hate amnesties. They like pardons because, you know, it's this thing about the facts were established, and then have the facts having been established, and then I'm okay. But an amnesty is a sort of like a thing that you give them the right not to prosecute without having established what actually happened. So that's really what they don't like. But listen, you know, if you read the documents, and I'm sure you have, you know, they talked about how amnesty are a standard feature of political processes all over Europe. And, you know, I was watching the Jordi Evole thing with Josu Turnera over the weekend, and you start to think about people in ETA who have given amnesty, who are like mass murderers and assassins. So, you know, I think that a lot of the Catalan people I've spoken to, you know, while they reserve the right to stand up and say, we have the whatever, in a kind of an academic sense, we still have the right to argue for independence. They don't like, you know, they have legal threats hanging over their wealth and stuff like that. And if they get a chance to kind of have a reset, a lesson has been learned, and you know, that kind of thing isn't going again. So that's the, I don't know, what you call it, a dialectic. That's the thing that you have to kind of live with, which is to say that I think they will, if asked, say, you know, are you going to continue to argue for independence? And they'll say, yes, of course we are, but not in the way that they did previously. And I think that is the difference. And the other thing, of course, going back to watching the Jordi Evole thing, is there's a certain Jose Maria Aznar, you know, says about the keeping people within the electoral system, how important that is, that you'd rather have them inside than outside. And I think, you know, would you rather have the Catalans boycotting the Spanish parliament, or would you rather have them in voting? So I think all those things, once you let them inside the system, the numbers are the numbers. And I just think that some people don't really understand politics is the art of the possible, and the stuff about Pedro Sanchez. And even like I'm a, you know, you start to read some of the legal arguments, and they kind of start off somewhere that, okay, I can start to see that. And then they make this incredible jump. And then suddenly, like, the rule of law is under threat, and the separation of powers is under threat.
Yeah.
And you start to go, hold on a second. Like, that's not a kind of a jump. So that's kind of where
I think that's the interesting point, isn't it? Because there, when we look elsewhere in Europe at amnesty legislation, etc., I don't, like, have there been similar arguments before? The fact that, you know, and it wasn't, we're not just talking about the right-wing media here or even right-wing politicians. We're talking about, you know, the pretty much all the judges' associations, the general counsel of the judiciary, you know, saying that this is the beginning at the end of the end of democracy. No, it's a pretty narrow amnesty law. I mean, there was a much
You could say it's the beginning of democracy as opposed to the end of.
I mean, there are issues around this amnesty, because obviously, like, one of the issues was how do you frame and justify an amnesty? An amnesty has to be justified in terms of the common good. They went with the line that it was about reconciliation. The Catalan independence parties initially wanted a stronger justification based around lawfare, based around the, you know, what are the most outrageous judicial sentences in Spain in terms of lawfare in the last 20 years has been the sedition charges. I mean, that the Catalan leaders were convicted of sedition was just incredible. Like, and the type of just, I mean, it has, obviously it was meant to be an exceptional ruling, but if that was a basic definition of sedition, basically anyone who engages in civil disobedience is potentially guilty of sedition and facing like 12 years in jail. There was a certain weaponization of the courts as a means to solve the 2017 crisis. And that had to
the thing is, this is a review of the year, you know, so you're going back to previous years. You want to redo the trial. You know, I don't say I completely agree with you. I think there were parts of that judgment that were weaker and parts of it that were stronger. You know, the idea that, like, this was a bunch of guys who did nothing, you know, I mean, the state has a right and indeed a duty to defend itself.
We're not going to replay the whole thing, but at no point was the state under any meaningful threat. It was a symbolic vote. This is where we get into the contradictions.
Mouth is open now, Owen. My mouth is open. My mouth is gasping.
No, but like,
open.
They had me.
You've got to be joking me here, right?
I'm well disposed
to you in general, but like, you've got to be joking to me.
That's the inner contradiction here, was the fact that it was only ever make believe. Like, there was no point was the Catalan independence movement
a serious threat to the Spanish state. It didn't have the capacity. Puigdemont made a symbolic declaration and then got into a car and fled the country. I mean, they didn't have, like, it got away from them. But they, you know, at no point were they involved in either violence or a serious attempt to question the Spanish state.
I mean, again, this is a year review now, so we'll have to, you know, we're going to have to go onto a premium feed. But like the thing is, like, you can't say nothing. I mean, I know. You know,
I'm not saying nothing. I'm not saying no. Of course, I'm not saying nothing. I'm not saying nothing happened. But it got away from them, and it got away from everybody in the sense that. But what was the trigger? The trigger was the violence on the 1st of October. This is really getting into it, but there is a sense that Rajoy himself had no interest, and that it was his deputy prime minister, Soraya, who she was the one who sent the police in. She was in control of the police, police operations on that day.
To try and get us back into this thing, where Rajoy... You know, this goes back to almost to the Gal thing about Felipe and like he let it happen, you know, that it was like, and Rajoy is exactly the same thing. You know, he let it happen. You know, he was the guy in the frame that could have stopped it. So he does hold responsibility for it. And I do think that this is the estatute. And I think that the PP made a political decision, you know, having, you know, to whatever you, if you want to use your favorite word, lawfare on that. But I think that was, you know, the same PP that are now complaining about, you know, judicialization and lack of separation of powers, you know, they had no issue, trying to use judges to overturn legislation and the Estatute, which was not in a controversial way. I mean, there were kind of things that there was kind of issues of the judgment. That had I think were what's called obiter, which is to use a legal term, but the PP definitely weaponized the Estatute for political aims, and if they were looking for conciliation, they could have said, okay, the judges have found that a couple of things need to be kind of tidied up and revised, and they could have just let that happen, and there would have been the process would not have developed a life of its own. I mean, I was told by a good Catalan friend of mine that was the thing that really started.
No, it is. Yeah. But I mean, what I would say here is that I think it's interesting the fact that I think since the pandemic, since 2020, other priorities have dominated, so obviously just a world health crisis, cost of living crisis, etc., have all dominated. The territorial question has sort of disappeared in the background. And I think if you had told any of us in June that this is what we'd be discussing at the end of the year, we wouldn't, you know, like the Catalan issue had sort of faded into the background. Obviously, the electoral results changed that. Sanchez won the election because
and the pardons thing were what really dampened it down. You know, letting the guys out of Sotoria, like I was last weekend, by the way, which is just to give a nice view.
It's a bit nice hiking up there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well,
what's interesting, but that was, I mean, so that turned, you know, I guess we started not so long ago talking about Pedro Sanchez, you know, and that was the thing that, like, that was a risk he took to let the guys out of jail, and he took it. And that has really, again, speaking to my friends in Catalonia, you know, that was something that really dampened the cause, you know, because people didn't like to see those guys in jail. And the fact that they were let out under caution, as they say, I think Junqueras is still not allowed to run for office and things like that. But that Pedro Sanchez took that initiative, and it has worked out in terms of, you know, lowering when the poll numbers are taken for, you know, how would you vote? He seems to have taken a lot of the heat out of the Catalan issue. So, you know, well paid Pedro Sanchez.
Moving on, I guess, to the question of this year's elections. The left didn't so much win as the right lost. And you can't, you know, you cannot win an election in Spain. You can win an election in Madrid, but you can't win an election in Spain by running against Catalonia and the Basque Country. Is there any route back to power for the Spanish right, which either doesn't involve them increasing their vote in Catalonia and the Basque Country, or be able to make alliances with Junts and the Basque Nationalist Party? Because at the moment, between those two areas of the Spanish state, they constitute like 10 million people. If you're getting 20% of the vote in Catalonia, and I think was it like 12% in the Basque Country? That's the combined vote of the Spanish right, the Pepe and Vox. You know, it's very hard to win them to govern on a national level.
I mean, I think the PNV spokesperson in the parliament said during the failed investiture of Fico, you tried to oil your tractor with the wrong kind of oil, like pointing towards Vox, which I suppose is the biggest contradiction to what you're to if they want to try and win in Catalonia and the Basque Country, then they have to lose Vox to the PP, because one of their long-standing policies is to abolish, and they've tried to recently do it in the Senate, right? They've tried to abolish regional parties.
Well, you have to go back to the reason Vox came about in the first place. It was a group of people who wanted to sort of, you know, move the discussion towards away from the center, away from the kind of catch-all party of Aznar to the mainstream kind of, you know, Christian Democrat right sort of stuff would be kind of a Voxy sort of issue. But and you know, this is the kind of whole Karl Rove thing, that if you get all of the people who feel like that, you can just about get a majority. And the thing was that they nearly did get a majority.
Yeah,
you know,
they did nearly.
Like, well, that's the thing. Yeah. You know, a couple of things could have fallen a couple of ways, and so you know, so at one level, you know, there's probably people in there arguing that, you know, if we just got a bit more turnout here and there, and we just got the left people not to show up, we might then, in the same way that Rove got Bush elected, with a sort of less than 50% of the vote. So, but I thought the other thing is that, you know, it's kind of, you know, close but no cigar, which is to say that there is a realization that, you know, there's always this thing in politics that, you know, at the end of the numbers, you know, the numbers are the numbers kind of thing. But it was very obvious to see that Vox was just a total. There's no point in talking to anyone whose political philosophy is based on that you do not exist. So you cannot have Vox anywhere when they're arguing for the end of, you know, for the recentralization of the Spanish state. I also, you know, it's been very bad. There's been a lot of debate in the PP for years. There was, particularly among, you know, you should see the smiles, you know, the Nuevos Generaciones people and Florida Blanca and all these kind of like younger PP fogies, the kind of people that Pablo Casado came out of. And they had for years been saying this, which is to say that, you know, that the PP shouldn't regard either the Basque Country or the or Catalonia as kind of territorio incognito, you know, that there was votes to be had there, that while they were never going to, you know, have majorities or anything, that the nationalists would always beat them, but that there was a kind of a view based around an economic argument, which was to say that, okay, the PP, like if they toned down that kind of the Spanish centralism stuff and toned up the whole economic message, that people would vote for them. But the one of the problems they've had, which is to say that the PP have kind of lost their economic message in its entirety and have now become very aligned towards what we'll end up calling the culture wars, even if you hate the phrase. So that's why they're losing votes in like the PP in both the Basque Country, in fact, nationally, you know, don't really have an economic message. They've been totally failed to promote that they are more capable of running the economy than the PSOE. So if you don't have that message, then you just fall back along tribal lines. And that's their biggest problem, which is to say that, you know, they have no argument as to say, so, you know, I mean, it's just... And it is
a genuine dilemma in that sense, because you can't really, I mean, I guess you can't leave your right flank open for Vox to move in further. So you still have to compete with Vox across much of the country.
I know I'm giving you a hard time on Catalonia, you know, I'm going to give you a hard time, but. Yeah, you know, like Aznar kind of did that, you know, which is to say, like, you know, I'm not going to say it out loud, but, you know, I am secretly thinking what you're thinking, you know, and you know, there, This is always the, I mean, both of you will be familiar with the phrase, which is to say people will always vote for the real thing, you know, which is, and that's always the thing about, and you see it again and again, and we're seeing it all over Europe, that every time centre-right parties move towards their right, supposedly not to leave their kind of, you know, flank unguarded, the people just either end up voting for the real thing, yeah, and then they...
But there is another element here, and I think this is one of the most interesting things, I guess, about Spanish politics is, yeah, like elsewhere in Europe, United States, etc., we're seeing a polarization being driven from, you know, in reactionary terms. But the core of Spanish reactionary nationalism has always been the internal enemy and not the external one. And so we don't see, I mean, it is there, you know, in when I was at the protest outside Ferrat, they were chanting, you know, anti-immigrant stuff. But at the end of the day, the chain of equivalence in constructing your enemy is more based around the internal enemy. It's more based around the Catalan, the Basque, and the Red, no? And that's what mobilizes people. So even you know, Vox has tried with like the sort of anti-immigrant stuff, but at the end of the day, Vox made its big breakthrough after 2017, around the internal threat to Spanish unity and not in terms of anti-migrant sentiments, which is what you get, I guess, as a key mobilizer elsewhere.
The thing about Vox is that there are a lot of, like, you know, Spain has this wonderful thing, some parts of which they liked the fact that Vox were a protest party. So a lot of people that previously voted for Podemos as the kind of, you know, play.
Well, that's not true. No, there was pretty much nobody switched from Podemos to Vox. Everybody had met a friend of a friend, but when you actually look at the data, I mean, less than 1%. You know, it was like minimal. So like that sort of horseshoe idea did not hold in Spain. Like we've all met one person, one crazy, but it wasn't a real phenomenon. It was the radicalization of the particularly younger right wing voters is Vox's main base. So like let's be clear, there is no horseshoe phenomenon in Spain. The data is very clear on that.
Okay, I have the data.
No, like it is. I'll send it to you after. Yeah.
But you know, I don't know. We'll have to, as I say, we'll have to keep that for the premium version. But, you know.
No, but that's always been
the... To be true, Owen, columnists would have to be wrong, you know, for you know, so, and political scientists would have to be right. But there's certainly many a newspaper columnist in Spain dined out on that whole idea.
One of the phenomenon, and this is what they do have in common with the United States, is you have two polarized blocks and there's no movement between the two. It's not... There are transversal phenomena such as Marine Le Pen in France that has managed to attract, you know, ex-communist voters. Or you could look in Italy, you know, some of these new protest parties that emerged have ideologically quite transversal voting blocks. But in Spain, no, it was always left and right. I mean, that was one of the things about even with Ciudadanos and Podemos was the fact that both Ciudadanos and Podemos in 2015, now we're even going further back, said they were neither left nor right. But at the end of the day, it was obvious that Podemos was a left-wing party, drawing their support from disenchanted ex-PSOE voters and Ciudadanos similar, you know, taking some voters from the center. They were slightly more successful. But no, like there has been two polarized blocks in Spain with pretty much no, I mean, there's,
I think,
like in the United States, just no transfer.
I think the interesting figure here, though, is Feijóo, because when he came in, everyone was sort of saying, oh, he's going to be, you know, kind of this moderate Rajoy. And around that time, there was talk of some, you know, some angry PSOE voters going towards the PP. And Feijóo was sort of seen as this, you know, not Ayuso, basically, you know, this more moderate figure. But he's completely adopted, as you were saying, Joe, you know, he's completely adopted this kind of culture wars rhetoric. So I just wondered, Joe, what give us what you think about Feijóo and his time as leader of the PP, because I think he's quite an interesting figure and we haven't really touched a lot on him on the podcast.
I don't think anyone accused him of being interesting, Alan. But, I know what you're saying. Well, he's in this line of another Rajoy kind of thing, you know, like literally circumstances, the road opened up to him. But, you know, the interesting, like, the PP need a Pedro Sanchez. You know, that's what they need. You know, they need to identify. And oddly enough, you know, because, of course, I teach in a business school, I have lots of former students, you know, these kind of American MBA type liberal people who were kind of flirted with politics and flirted with the PP. And all of them, you know, would actually have been, you know, if they'd stayed with the thing, would be quite credible now. You know, they're articulate, they're English speaking, they've worked in the private sector. You know, they have all of these things, but like the PP just seem to be going from bad to worse. I mean, they just seem to be unable to produce. And that's where the envy comes. That's what the Pedro Sanchez thing, it's really personal. They hate the fact that he moves well in Europe. You know, Ursula von der Leyen seems to have a kind of a crush on him. you know, he gets called in the important meetings, you know, like, you know, all of that. And like the BP, I mean, they don't even have, you know, Feijóo, Casado, like they've nobody like that. And that is kind of what they really need to do. They need to try and find some kind of guy somewhere or gal somewhere that they can, that has, is kind of, you know, credible, international, likable, rather than, you know, this kind of like throwback that Feijóo is. So I think that, you know, in the same way that where would PSOE be without Sanchez? Because they don't really have much of a deep bench either. So, but that's what the PP need. They need to somehow, I mean, people look at Moreno in Andalusia, you know, he's again of Andalusia very much, you know, and so.
But to be fair, to be fair, Joe, Sanchez has sort of grown into the role. No, I mean, as we said at the beginning, he was, when he turned up, nobody was saying, you know, people were describing him as a Ken doll, as, you know, sort of cut out politician, but not much substance. Yeah, I mean, I get it's hard to tell beforehand, isn't it? And I guess
anyone in the PP that you know of is kind of, you know, has that kind of profile of Sanchez, you know, I guess tall, good looking, worked in the private sector, speaks English, you know, kind of. I mean, I watched his interview with Susana Griso was amazing. I don't know whether you subjected yourself through it, but, you know, she came in with like, I'll give this guy a dusting down. And by the end of it, she was like, so what are you up to later, Pedro? You know what I mean? And at the end of it, she was.
The other question, though, Joe, is would that type of thing, I mean, you can point to certain figures who more or less fit that bill, but would they get elected? Like, the thing is, it's just, you know, it's the same with the Republican Party in the US. Those type of figures just aren't going to get elected, you know, internally as the leader. And that's the issue. No, that's, you know, I guess someone like Borja Semper, no, could fit that build, but there's zero chance he'll ever be leader. Or you look at a figure that potentially could have fit that build, someone like Alberto Rivera. And then, you know, he got completely lost in sort of reactionary nationalism, you know, trying to outdo Vox by the end. So
there's a whole pile of these people, and the PP need to, you know, that's why I, in writing for an article I'm writing for The Currency, I might as well give The Currency a flip. Like I sort of said, like the PP are like still three leaders away from having a credible leader. So they have to go through the whole like Feijóo collapse, crashing and burning, and then they'll have to go to the Ayuso crashing and burning, and then they'll have to go to the Moreno crashing and burning. So, you know, they're like, they're three crashing and burning leaders away from somebody who can, you know, who can basically, as you say, like Borja Semper. I mean, that's not a bad name actually to throw
like,
at me.
Just in terms of like in generally fitting that bill.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but the point is someone like that is not going to get it. Like, you know, he's seen as too soft for the PP at the moment. No, I mean, the fact that he spoke a couple of lines of Basque in the Spanish Parliament, he was then forced to apologize afterwards. I mean, when we talk about the culture war stuff, there's just no room. I mean, the fact is, they
don't know whether it comes from the grandees or something like that. Like, I mean, you someone like the I guess Aznar or something has to kind of say, listen, guys, in politics, the only thing that counts is winning. The famous Mary Harney line of like, you know, the worst day in government is better than the best day in opposition. And you know, that he has to bring that kind of mentality to the party, which is to say, I mean, the PP are furious because there's all this Euro lolly coming their direction and they're not in charge of doling it out. You know, that's I mean, that's as much as why they're angry with Pedro Sanchez about Spain. Because they're really furious about that. So this is the thing that there are people who, you know, live from politics and politics, you know, clientelism and stuff like that, who are sitting, listen, guys, we're out of government now. My, you know, my funds are drying up a bit. My chiringuitos are, you know, in need of some watering. So, you know, we need to get back into power here. And if Borja Semper is the guy, then we're going to, you know, get behind him. I think we might need to do a bit better than him, but you know, that is.
I would also push back, because, okay, for me, Aznar is a brilliant politician. I think he's the one right wing politician that, you know, from progressive and left wing perspectives, we should study, because I think he's, you know, he's a fantastic fantastic politician. But he's nearly a Gramscian politician. He has a certain idea of what hegemony is, which isn't just about being in office. He very much understands that you need to build a whole, you know, social support structure in the media, in the judicial system, etc., to then be able to propel your project forward. Him and his regional chiefs in Madrid created Madrid as a financial center, wanted to basically mold a certain financial elite, you know, people like Florentino Perez. There's also a huge difference between Aznar's first term, in which he had to do deals with the Catalans, and his second term, in which he had an absolute majority and was much more of an ideologue. Because one of the other interesting statistics is, okay, 60% of Spanish people in polling are opposed to the amnesty law. Well, Aznar went into the Iraq war with 80% of the Spanish population opposed to the war. No, but he did then win the local elections the following year, I think, and probably would have won the general election if he hadn't lied about the Atocha terrorist attacks. So I think it would be a mistake to call Aznar some sort of pragmatist who's willing to win at all costs. I think he's actually, he has a very clear political and ideological project, and he's willing to do what he has to drive that forward. But for him, I mean, he's also the one who's pushing. He's one of the key people pushing Feijóo to the right now. In a sense, he has led this patriotic charge. He has led this patriotic charge against Sanchez. He basically, his announcement in an interview said, anyone who can do something to stop this grave threat to Spanish democracy has to do it. And literally the next day, one judge in the Audiencia Nacional charged Puigdemont with terrorism. Yeah.
I think, you know, it's interesting. If you go back on YouTube and watch the debates between Felipe González and Aznar is he's a kind of like a figure, like a kind of an obscure tax inspector kind of person. If you want to talk about somebody who grew into a role, who grew into power, you know, José María Aznar is exactly that kind of person. You know, it's almost unrecognizable from the figure that we see today, you know. But he very much has grown into the role. But you're right. I heard that interview as well, and he kind of turns down a lot more interviews than he's under huge pressure. Like, all the media want him for interviews. He's invited to an awful lot of party gatherings and stuff like that, much more than Rajoy. But he kind of stays away from it. And he came out. He did agree to that one and talk about that. But I really wonder. I really wonder what that's up to. I think he's more interested in kind of business interests than he is Spain.
That's true as well. Yeah.
I mean, he's on
the boards of some companies and things like that,
and his son works for Goldman Sachs, etc.
That's his son, I think, actually.
His son works for Goldman Sachs, but his family basically has a strategic partnership with Goldman Sachs. I mean, His wife famously sold, was it like 30,000 social housing units to the company, etc. No, but like, it's the same. I mean, when you look at Santander,
I did an interview with Jesus Cintura, and I said something like that. Said basically what you said, and they couldn't run it, you know, because they didn't have the.
I don't think Aznar's going to listen to the podcast, but anyway.
Yeah, they didn't have the. Well, you know, his English is pretty good now, anyway.
It's not bad, actually.
I know what you're saying. In terms of Aznar, he's very much, he's on boards and he's paid kind of fees to argue for certain things happen, and that's kind of the direction he's coming from, rather than constitutionally. I think that, you know, when Felipe Gonzalez talks, he is speaking from a constitutional sense. You know, he has more of a sense of those kind of things. But yeah, I'm not sure what Aznar is really about there. But he doesn't seem to have. He, you know, in his relationship with Ayuso, he's not actively pushing Ayuso, even though you would think that they would find common ground.
But obviously her main spin doctor, Mar, no, like was Aznar's old spin doctor. I mean, it is all. I mean, and Enrique Juliana, the La Vanguardia director in Madrid, describes Aznar as still 20 years after leaving Paris. He still is the strategic director of the Spanish right. His maneuvering after the elections in response to the amnesty law clearly shows he took the lead. He is the key figure because he's also the godfather the political godfather of a lot of the Vox leadership. I mean, Abascal worked for his think tank.
Excuse me, Owen, I'd like to withdraw the words Abascal and work
in the same sentence. Well, he drew a salary, let's say. He drew a salary.
Yes, indeed. I think that's about the only all the people leaving Vox, whether it's you know, whatever, Ivan or
I mean, he likes a lion, you know, who can blame him?
You know, he likes a lion, but yeah. So, you know, for a man who's into like blood and sweat and toil and stuff like that, he doesn't seem to, as you say, himself, and he doesn't seem to get up very early in the morning.
Yeah. No, just gonna say, just before we go on to Vox, I mean, do you think, you said, Joe, you said, you know, Ayuso crash and burn, but do you think sooner or later she's going to be their answer to electoral success? I mean, she's basically quashed Vox in the region of Madrid. Or is she not, as a lot, many people say, you know, Madrid is not Spain and Spain is not Madrid. What do you think about Ayuso taking the reins?
The funny thing, there's a great cartoon of her, you know, waving the Madrid flag. You know, she is to Madrid is to Spain like Catalonia is to Spain. You know, she's kind of increasingly, there's all sorts of competencies she's claiming to have control of that she doesn't actually have. So she's trying to run Madrid as, you know, an independent republic. You know, she might be on trial for secession pretty soon, you know, if we can get a few judges to do something. But yeah, I mean, I think that the whole Ayuso thing, you know, she'll go for it, of course, because, you know, she, you know, I mean, if you look at the, you know, she doesn't waste her time to do things like passing any laws. If you look at the amount of legislation that's gone through the Madrid parliament, like it's staggeringly bare. So, you know, all she really has is like running for office, you know, and going on to the next stage. That's really all she has. So, you know, I guess Feijóo is that situation. I mean, you know, the situation resolved itself in terms of Pedro is now the prime minister, and everyone just took a deep breath and said, okay, we'll resume hostilities in January. So let's see kind of what she comes out with. You know, it's like on to the next election, Europeans, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I would imagine that I also think Feijóo probably realizes his chance is gone and is probably heading towards Galicia in some shape or another as soon as the right kind of compromise can be formed. So, but, you know, what will happen? Yeah, I guess she'll get a run at it. You know, I can't really see anything else. I don't think it will go very well. But, you know, events, dear boy, you know, who knows what will jump into the frame.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is where Vox comes in. I mean, it's, as Alan was saying, the route to crushing Vox would seem to be go with Ayuso. But can we, like, I mean, I guess when we look elsewhere in Europe, we look, you know, the election of someone like Milei in Argentina, Trump maybe is coming back next year. In a quite proportional electoral system, it seems like there should be and there is likely to be space for a far-right party. Maybe one of its great weaknesses is Abascal. Abascal, I think, is probably reaching his limit as a leader. He just seems like such a traditional right-wing leader. He can't quite break out of that sort of far-right traditional mold. You know, have the sort of communicative skill of someone like Maloney in Italy, who is able to sort of reach a bit further beyond that base. I mean, where
Vox with either Macarena Olena or else even Della Monteros, Espinosa de Montero. I always get such a name mixed up. I travel with a guy actually whose name is so long that it's always a terrible problem in visas because they can't. His name is like even Della Monteros, Della something else. They can't fit it on the form. But what's interesting is like with either of those two, Vox would be a much more powerful and interesting party, both of whom were very capable people. And that they have kind of decided this is not for them kind of tells you. And then you're left with you know, the guy I call whose book you've actually read, Owen, you know, you have them this looking scary guy. So it's like, you know, imagine like this is Vox. Like it's like you're dealing with Abascal and you can never pronounce it properly. What's his name?
Bouchite, yeah, Bouchite. Yeah.
So that's what you've got. You know, like that's not going to be either populist or so. I don't know. I think Vox, you know, might be kept alive by the international correspondence of the Washington Post and the New York Times.
But it's also a far right international. I mean, the fact is, this weekend Abascal was in Rome with Maloney, with the Italian Prime Minister, meeting Elon Musk. I mean, it's not, you know, it's
not actually as well, who's now converted into you know, a commoner garden fascist.
Exactly. So you have this network of international support behind Vox. You have Tucker Carlson turning up, but that doesn't necessarily translate into domestic terms. In terms of an international environment, it should be, the international environment seems like one which is very positive for Vox to grow in.
I know. I'm not seeing a good year for them. I you know, you, what are they going to do? Like they don't have they don't have good people. Like they, you know, a lot of, you know, fascism does come down to bread and butter issues, you know, and they are about as far away from bread and butter issues as can possibly be had. And you know, you do see parties that are on the rise, you know, notably Bildu in the Basque Country. You know, they're there by getting out and you know, constituents meetings and, you know, fixing the road and all that kind of stuff. Like that's the road to it. And you even see that in the, you know, the Alternative for Deutschland people. You know, those guys are like visible in the community. You know, they're holding meetings and you know, doing that Golden Dawn, you know, similar kind of stuff. Like, and that's what Vox, like, are about as far away from that as possible. So, you know, I don't think Vox are that are that interesting, because the PP are starting to realize that they're a problem in terms of getting back into power, and they don't have a base that sees that they're going to make their lives better. So you, what their box is basically like, you know, sort of very wealthy, privileged people in Madrid who live off. You know, I mean, I think I remember seeing some of the protests and thinking, do these people not have to be in work, you know? But no, because they live off like renting houses and you know.
I did enjoy some of the protests in Faraf. I went a couple of nights, and one of the police charges, it was quite funny because, you know, a lot of people had sort of retreated to the terraces to have a glass of wine. And so you had all these sort of fachas on the terraces drinking wine. And as the police charge, they start throwing their wine glasses at the police. You know, it's not exactly working.
I mean, it's like the joke about the Catalan protests, you know, and hitting the police over the head with their Louis Vuitton handbags. You know, it's sort of like, you know, guys, will you at least look as if you're oppressed? You know, as opposed to, you know, that's a very expensive raincoat you're wearing there. But yeah, no, like, I mean, the Fox thing, I just don't think that's interesting. I mean, we started talking about Pedro Sanchez as being, you know, an example for the left, and you know, doesn't get all the credit for, you know, many brave decisions he's take, many good political choices, and has, you know, we all feared, and I use the word in the sense at which it's commonly understood, like Vox in government could have happened and it didn't, and that's down to Pedro Sanchez. Vox have, there's a realization now that they're a problem in terms of the right gaining into power, and then the right then has this problem with the leader. So, you know, this idea of you could be tuning in from abroad and thinking like that the, you know, the new year is going to be difficult for Pedro Sanchez. But I don't think that's the case. I think the economy and I think people from the left coming at him are going to be a bigger issue. I don't see either the PP or Vox you know, causing difficulties for Pedro Sanchez in the new year.
I mean, I don't, were you guys not surprised at the extent and the ability to keep these protests going? No, I mean, they were larger than I expected, but it's also that they have continued for longer. And obviously the tactic over the next 6 months leading up to the European elections in June of next year for the PP is, you know, extend the amnesty out as far as possible. It's approval. No, they're going to block it as long as it is possible in the Senate, have the final vote as near as possible to the June election. So basically, they're going to fight the European elections as a referendum on the amnesty law. Vox again made its breakthrough on the territorial issue, on the threat to Spanish unity. Abascal did, you know, was front and center at the Ferraz protests, as were other Vox leaders. They always left before the violence really got out of control, but they went, you know, a lot of nights they were there, very warmly received. Obviously, that's a very particular audience. I mean, again, we have to be very clear. If we're saying Vox is uninteresting, if it's going nowhere, and if the right's only route back to power is some sort of pragmatic leader, well, I mean, that's going against all international trends. Everywhere else is showing the right's route back to power is with populism. It's with, you know, Trump is going to get reelected probably next November, which is a high possibility.
Spain is different, you know.
We have to go further.
What else can I say? You know, we have you say, Pedro Sanchez is unlike almost every other leader on the left. You know, the Italian left has disappeared, the Greek left has disappeared, the Labour Party in Ireland. You know, I mean, you know, laugh out loud kind of stuff. You know, so Spain is different.
Sinn Féin is obviously leading polls in Ireland. The issue, obviously, is the one thing Sanchez did, which Keir Starmer has refused to do with the left, is the fact that Sanchez understood the need to work with the left. And that brings us on, obviously, to Podemos, Sumar, etc. Is the fact that he, coming back in 2016, 2017, after he lost the socialist leadership, he ran on, an alliance with Podemos against his party's right, against Susana Díaz and the socialist right of a grand alliance. He was like, no, we are the left, and we should be proud to be left wing, and we will work with Podemos. And obviously at that point, Podemos was a party with 5 million votes. It was, you know, 70 plus MPs. It was a relationship much more nearly between equals. Obviously his other great success has been the fact that now you have the left as very much a junior partner, split. We can talk about that.
Yeah, that was
just the Sumar Podemos divorce. But you also have the Socialist Party as the center of this governing bloc, surrounded by 6 small parties, in which Sanchez is the key figure dialoguing with all these small parties, as opposed to, as you would have had in 2016, an alliance between equals, between the radical left and Sanchez.
I mean, if European elections are framed as do you support the amnesty or not by the right, I think Sanchez could look to gain from it, because he's one of 3 on the left, you know, and Podemos and Sumar are going separately in the European elections. There's no doubt about that, and I think they're going to be in their own little world arguing about who's the bigger fish on the left of the PSOE. And if it does go that way, I'm sure Sumar will try to not get into that fight. But if it does go that way, if Podemos are able to pull Sumar into this like battle of who's going to be the real left, as it were, then Sanchez and the PSOE could hoover up a lot of votes for people that, you know, are in favor of the government and are in favor of the amnesty.
I think it's well. Probably, I don't think they are going to be really that bothered about the European elections. Like,
it's true.
You know, like if Irene Montero wants to go to Brussels, you know, I'll drive you to the airport. You know, and that's where she wants to be, the international queen of left, the only heir of true feminism and true socialism. She'd find loads of like wackos in the European Parliament that will like, Irene, you know. And so I think, you know, it's one of those things about like, you know, you know, my wife sometimes says to me, like, I'm so angry, I'm not going to talk to you. And you're like, ooh, okay, if that's the punishment I have to accept, then, you know, I'll just read this book for the rest of the evening. So I think, you know, I was reading Arendt's kind of like Arendt's sort of thing about, you know, I'll show you with the European election. I think Sumar might try and sort of say, okay, you want Europe, you can have Europe, you know, and yeah, that's all fine with us. And then meanwhile, as you know, Yolanda and the others, she'll quietly consolidate all of the people from Podemos who are moving over to Sumar, and basically you'll be left with Podemos as being whoever is sitting around Pablo Iglesias's kitchen on a, you know, Friday evening. That's basically will be what's left of Podemos. So I don't think it's going to be the you know, Irene's big tactical move. You know, I don't think it's going to be that dramatic. I think that Yolanda Díaz is in politics to do things like minimum wage, to her vision of feminism is creating, you know, refuges for women, and you know, those are kind of the things she talks about. So she's just quite happy to let you know, Podemos continue with their kind of student politics and that kind of stuff. So that's how I see Europe happening. I think the other thing, not to get back onto Catalan, is that the worst kept secret is that Puigdemont is going to say that what I thought was agreed wasn't agreed, and he's going to definitely run on I was tricked. So, you know, that's going to be the other interesting part. But yeah, the left stuff is very, I mean, it's a hell of a kind of, you know, you have to say Yolanda's political skill, she has navigated that well. You know, she had to bring in the numbers for Pedro Sanchez. Otherwise, you know, she was a key part, in the same way we've lionized Pedro Sanchez for keeping Vox out, she was a key part in keeping up the vote on her side. So, you know, she does, and she gets back into, you know, we can talk about whether she was wise to exclude Irene Montero and Ione Belarra, but you know, she brought in the numbers, and she was a key part in keeping Vox out of power as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wrote a piece about a month ago, and I said her record as a government minister, as a left wing government minister, is unparalleled in Europe. No, I mean, I think she has a clear governmental record, which is overwhelmingly positive. I have questions around her leadership as a party political leader, though, in part because, I mean, Sumar is itself is as a project remains, it needs to be developed. It hasn't, you know, obviously the elections came early. These were snap elections. I remember talking to her advisors, and they were absolutely certain that there would not be early elections. They were running. There's no way. They were like, Pedro Sanchez wants to use the European presidency to launch his campaign. It'll be November, December. And they were caught out. And then their campaign wasn't ready. The first few weeks were obviously taken up by negotiations, trying to come up with lists. There hadn't been any lists agreed at that point. And so they were caught out. I was doing a talk with Sebastian Faber the other week. He described their campaign as too much resembling a think tank campaign, that it was so many new ideas. It was new ideas every day. And they were quite interesting on a level of policy, but in terms of a rapid 4-week election campaign, they just confused people. And there was a sense, I mean, and this is one of the issues here, is that we can talk about Podemos' decline and, you know, rapid decline, and it's now sort of stuck in this sort of paranoid defensive positioning. But the initial Podemos obviously stood out in terms of its communication strategy, its freshness and its ability to connect with, you know, the sort of the bread and butter issues that people were concerned with in that moment. The Sumar campaign was rescued in the last week, but there was, you know, their own internal voting showed that the majority of Sumar voters were against some of their own policies and didn't understand. I mean, the majority of their voters didn't understand the universal inheritance scheme. It was too confusing, it was brought in so late. Then they went on to like reducing the work week, and people were confused about that, how it was going to work. And there was a sense that like her work as a governmental leader was based around delivering very concrete material bread and butter demands. And in a sense, it was Pedro Sanchez who talked more about
the minimum wage and stuff in the election campaign. She turned it around, and I think it was thanks to the comunas in Barcelona. Their voting, their internal polling showed this, was that, like, look, you've got to go on the offensive. You've got to, like, and so in the last week in the debate, she turned it around when she started talking about when she went after Abascal and took a very strong anti-right line. But 3 or 4 weeks beforehand in her interview and El Intermedio, she said, oh, I'm not going to say one bad word about any of my opponents. That's politics. You have, you know, and so I think her campaign was a bit muddled. She is an incredible parliamentarian when she goes after the right, when they try and attack her and she comes back with her advances and her brilliant, you know, she has this incredible memory, recall of figures, etc. So I think her campaign was a bit of a muddle. It did pay off at the end. The last week sort of turned it around. And I think that's, I mean, sorry?
She does have a decency about her that radiates.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
And that's,
and it's sort of like, exactly. Okay, I don't really understand it, but I don't dislike you. And I think that, you know, the famous thing about, you know, if you're ever, I mean, and there's an interview question you prepare people for. If you're ever arrested by someone and you have one phone call to make, you know, Oleana is the kind of person you would call, you know, that she'll kind of help you. But yeah, I absolutely, you know, the lack of kind of structures around her very much let her down.
Look, they were cut out. They expected to have an extra 6 months to organize.
I suppose that's the thing as well, right? I mean, you know, we forget as well that Podemos was built from the bottom up, even though it was a top-down organization. It was built from Quinta M, whereas Somar has been born from government. I mean, it's been born from a government that was, you know, this first 2 years was just pure coronavirus, and then you have the Ukraine war, and then, I mean, launching Somar from a vice presidency, completely, you know, I completely agree with the think tank comment. I think that's true. And, you know, you cannot campaign on your smile alone, which was one of the biggest complaints about it, is that, you know, it's just all smiles.
You can make, you can get away with it once, but you can't do it repeatedly.
Yeah.
You know, I think she, I, in terms of, you know, she was caught out and things like that, she was very firm about not letting Irene Montero on her lists. And Podemos were kind of cut out in that they really had, I think it might have come down to as little as 24 hours to kind of, like, you have to be either in or out. If that was a longer time, they might have had the backbone to not go in. So there were a few things, you know, it's the old Napoleon thing about being a lucky general, and I think Yolanda Díaz has been a lucky politician in lots of instances. But
I mean, I think the other issue, and I think on balance she was right to exclude Irene Montero,
Can you just like increase the audience? Say it one more time. On balance, she was right to exclude her anyone there. Okay.
She was right. I mean, I think there are various issues. Like, basically, it's a contested leadership transition. I think the response from the Podemos leadership over the last year has been overwhelmingly, I don't know why. Well, they are stuck in a defensive, nearly paranoid loop. I think at times, for example, I think they should have given them a ministry. I think you can make a distinction between Irene Montero and Yoni Belarra. I think someone like Yoni Belarra could have continued in the government. It was a big, I mean, this is the big gamble, because Podemos have no bright future ahead of them now, but they might just have enough weight left to wreck Sumar. And I think it's a big wager to leave them outside. We'll see if it pays off. But
they offered other Podemos figures, just not Irene Montero or Iono Balara. They did offer Podemos other ministries.
No, they didn't offer Podemos. They didn't offer. I mean, that is the difference. Is that every other formation was allowed to choose their minister? I think what Yolanda Díaz has done is she's managed to bring pretty much most of the left with her, including most of the useful active leadership members within Podemos. You know, what's left in the party is a pretty sad rump. And, you know, when you're talking when you look at their events, it's just like sort of mainly pensioners who turn up for these events now. You know, these sort of fogies exactly. Yeah, it's all pretty sad. I mean, it is a pity. I think, you know, Pablo stepped back when he stepped back 2.5 years ago. That was a perfect moment to step back, but of course he didn't really step back. So.
No. I mean, it's as many people
have
said.
Spend more time with the media, yeah. Anyway.
I mean, as many people have said, you know, Podemos is now the political arm of Canal Red. I mean, Canal Red is kind of key with all of this. I mean, the attacks they've made on ex-Podemos members, like high-profile ones, you know, the ex-candidate to be mayor of Madrid, the ex-candidate to be mayor of the Comunidad de Madrid. Nacho Álvarez, who was, you know, wanted to be the minister, and even, you know, spreading fake news. Canal Red has written one article in English, and it was a complete fabrication about Ione Belarra being sacked from government because of a stance on Palestine, which, you know, was completely false. Caused chaos. And I mean, that just sort of speaks volumes of this bunker mentality of Podemos have got at the moment. And that's what they're going to try and do in Europe, right? I mean, they're just out to wreck Samar. It's like, I can't have the toy. You can't have my toy. I want to play with it.
Well, there's all sorts of oddballs. Yeah. You'll find there's lots of oddballs in Europe who are kind of, you know, they'll find a lot of companies.
Do you have any particular oddballs of mind, Joe?
Well, I mean, maybe. You know, that's where Nigel Farage hung out for years and years and years. You know? And then, of course, we have Mick and Claire, right? You know, who look like they'll get reelected in Ireland. So, you know, that's European is the European Parliament is not the center of politics in Europe. You know, it's a sort of a mix of oddballs and people that get sent over. So. I don't think that's not the place from which to begin your comeback. You know, it's the place from which you formally admit you've given up. I think that Pedro Sanchez and Yolanda Díaz, who I think can be regarded as a double act, I think their problems are going to come more from economic issues, political issues, you know, those legislative issues, those kind of places, rather than, you know, like personal attacks or maneuvers or something like that. That's where I think, like, it's the economy, stupid, you know, is where they're going to have their problems.
Well, like, I guess to wrap up, I mean, how do you see this government developing? I mean, you know, it's in terms of its parliamentary majority, passing legislation is not going to be easy, particularly once the amnesty law comes into effect, I presume by next summer at least, you know, and as Joe, as you were saying, Puigdemont at that point will be gearing up to be the candidate in the Catalan elections. I mean, this government probably, it needs 2 to 3 years in terms of to deliver on some other issues apart from Catalonia, but its parliamentary majority is very complex. Any laws passed, you're going to need, you know, the neoliberal Basque Nationalist Party. What is possible, and how long do you see this government lasting?
Governments have a handle, you know, it's like CEOs say, never have a credible challenger, you know, and that's always the thing about Pedro Sanchez, is there's nobody, okay, tell me who, you know, like, what are you going to do? Sure. Okay, everyone votes against him, and then who what follows? So, you know, I think everything is going to have to be fought for line by line. But like, that's actually what politics is supposed to be. And if you look at, you know, that's how Germany and the Netherlands and these kind of countries, what you have is a whole pile of parties who, you know, agree or don't disagree based on legislative issues. I mean, we have both in Ireland, I guess, and the UK and even in Spain, we've traditionally had basically, you know, one side wins and then has a majority and then legislates like that. They just decide what laws they want to pass and have the majority to pass them. And that's the model we've been familiar with. But we're possibly going to a more of a, you know, other countries in Europe model whereby legislation has to, because you don't have an overall majority, you actually have to cobble it together by getting votes and support. So I think that's kind of how it will happen. But, you know, Johns are seeing investment being distracted. They're losing investment in certain areas they want to have. And if, you know, if that can, they're certainly quite happy to stroll in into the lobby whenever is required. I don't think that, same way in the Basque Country, like they're, you know, largely, I was in the Basque Country last week and I was asking some people and they were kind of saying like Madrid is just a distant thing, you know, for us. Like we're concerned with local issues and that's where our battles are fought. And they just need there to be a government in Madrid that kind of largely leaves them alone. And that's Pedro Sanchez's style, which is to say, okay, you can have everything, you know, you can have your own stuff, but, you know, don't threaten national integrity. Whereas PP or Vox, you know, can't help themselves kind of cause trouble. So I think that Pedro's, you know, 4 years is a long time to say that he can get all the way. But I don't think it's impossible. And from what I hear, I think he quite likes the idea of having two full terms. And he quite likes the idea of, you know, he's not in any hurry. Some people say he's in a huge hurry to get this big job in Europe kind of thing, or even this big global kind of United Nations-y thing. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think he quite likes being Prime Minister of Spain. He quite likes the fact that he has occasional trips to Europe and stuff like that. But fundamentally, I think he's quite up for, you know, achieving something in Spain. So I don't think like with the lack of an alternative is always, you know, the thing that will keep any movement from happening. So I don't think it's impossible, even though the majority is wafer thin, that it could go a lot farther than people expect. But, you know, it's always economic issues, you see, or even geopolitical issues. And that will always be, I think Spain's economy, which is sort of what I look at, you know, there's a lot of very worrying things that we need to think about there. You know, the price of oil or, you know, gas, whatever you call it, those kind of things can start to cause huge issues. And then
or olive oil as well, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, listen, I mean, that's quite incredible. You know, I mean, I keep expecting it to come down and it's still up there, you know.
I mean, I agree with you, Joe. And I'd like to see more politics about hospitals and employment and stuff. But unfortunately, I think the Achilles heel might be the amnesty law. I think we're going to see full throttle lawfare with regards to the amnesty law. I don't know what you think, Owen.
The law has been designed to give judges the least room possible. No, I mean, once the law comes into effect, there's a 2-month limit for it to be applied to all cases. The only issue is whether judges have the right not to apply it if they believe it's against European law. But they've left pretty much no room for maneuver, because we saw the fuck up with the last year with the only yeses. Judges, yes.
You know, you judges have done, I mean, they applied C law, even though they have gritted teeth. You know, these constructionist judges are, you know, they will give out about it, but they have a firm belief that the law is the law. And if this is, you know, they you won't get kind of rogue judges or stuff like that, and that things. So I think a lot of it will kind of get sorted out in the background rather than, you know, formal kind of declarations. You won't have people like going out of courtrooms, hands in the air kind of thing. So
no,
you'd be surprised. Although maybe you will have, you know, Puigdemont walking down the street.
Well, I think, you know, his return will certainly be interesting. No, I think it'll be an interesting day.
Well, if Girona win the La Liga, you know, I mean, he won't stay. He won't stay in Waterloo for that one. You know, I mean, if that does happen, he'll quite happily take his chances and say, you know, arrest me if you dare. But I don't know. I think that what I see very much is that Catalan politicians are saying to their base, we don't renounce the right. I mean, you read Pere Aragonés's thing in the FT recently was very much of that kind of, you know, in the same way that I don't renounce the right to date Angelina Jolie or whoever picked random celebrity. Like you know, Angelina Jolie is not in her intray kind of thing. So there was very much, you know, I do not give the right, but they're very
well. When you look, I mean, there is, you know, this they got a terrible report from, you know, in terms of Catalan education system. There's issues about drought and water supply. I mean, there's very concrete issues which need to be dealt with. And there is a sense that I think Catalan civil society and the electorate is a bit exhausted with the national question. And I think, yeah, the priority there, I mean, they're going to be up against a socialist party that's going to be the largest party, most likely. So I think we're going to see quite a distinct Catalan election. Well, look, Joe, this has been a marathon session. Alan jumped off about 5 or 10 minutes ago. He had to go. We thought we had enough time, but I think we'd be talking for about 2 hours at this point. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up. And look, thanks for your time, for your analysis, happy Christmas.
A pleasure as always. It was a huge rating winner last year. So let's see whether we were, it was first time lucky or whether we've managed to
find a winning formula. Yeah.
It will continue the same time next year.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, look, thanks a lot, Joe.
Okay. Thank you.